and Eve and Common. It was like a salon. I remember more than once coming home to find a huge jam session already in progress. And not just in progress, getting out of control with too many people and too much noise. I was the buzzkill. I would run to my bedroom, grab the telephone. It was one with a cord. It's back in the 20th century. And call the police to report a disturbance. I narked out the noisemakers in my own house. But I saw how amazingly it created a space where people could work together, where ideas took hold, where they bounced off one brain into another brain. Early on in the book, I talked about cognitive disinhibition and how a Harvard psychologist developed a theory that creative people filter the world around them differently, or rather less. They see too much. It gets in their head. They have no choice but to make things. That's what St. Albans was like all the time back then. The pebble went into the pond and rippled. What was happening at St. Albans expanded into two nightclubs, the Five Spot in Philly and the Wetlands in New York. That part of the scene focused largely on the roots and hip-hop, and not only launched all those careers, but brought us back into contact with Scott Storch. And when that version of the movement went from cocoon to butterfly around 1999, the Roots released Things Fall Apart, went platinum, and hit the road, and other artists in that circle emerged. The collective morphed into the Black Lily movement, which kept things going when we were touring. Black Lily focused primarily on female or female-centric artists like Jazzy Fat Nasties, Jaguar Wright, and Jill Scott. Floetry arrived stateside from London to become part of the collective. Les Nubians came from Paris. Kindred the Family Soul led the second wave of acts. The 8-year-old Jasmine Sullivan slept backstage for most of the evening and then came on stage to perform. At the same time, James Poyser and I, working mainly with Erykah Badu and then later D'Angelo and Common, right here at Electric Lady Studios in New York, rather than in the nightclubs, evolved yet another version of the musical collective, which we called the Soulquarians. People like Bilal, Nick Acosta came around. Others came back around. There was an after effect that resounded in the music world in the years since as well. The musicians who worked steadily through that period as teens, Adam Blackstone, Omar Edwards, and others, have become the backbone for major stars like Rihanna, Jay-Z, Adele, and The Weeknd. And then there are the technical support personnel, the lighting directors, and the sound man, and the tour managers. All in all, there are probably 100 careers that grew out of that fertile soil. That's one model of collaboration. Put everyone in one place and see what happens. There are obviously tons of examples throughout history that have worked this way. But there are other models, too, that have to do with learning how to reach out, how to stretch your arms, how to close your hands around what you find when they're outstretched, and how to bring it back into your world. In the spring of 2017, I conducted a series of conversations at Pratt Institute with other creative artists. And for one of those, I spoke to film director Ava DuVernay. She spoke about the importance of using her films to communicate a personal message, but she also spoke about the strategy of creating a distribution collective to ensure that work made by filmmakers of color reaches its audience. Her organization, Array, puts movies in theaters and also on Netflix. Array has a collective goal, and it recognizes that there is strength in numbers. Import importance. The album we put out around the time of Voodoo, Things Fall Apart, was our most acclaimed album and our best-selling one, too. It was a watershed moment for the group. When it came time to record a follow-up, I wanted to be aggressive about pushing the envelope artistically. Because of Things Fall Apart, most people saw us within the context of neo-soul. I didn't want to repeat that. I wanted to show that we were much more than that. That we could pick up the threads of our past releases. We had flirted with acid jazz on Do You Want More in 94, and Wu-Tang-ish dense hip-hop on Illadelph Half-Life in 96, but also weave a new tapestry. There is also a psychological dimension to the departure, a fear of following up, or a desire to step away from the work that you've already made before the audience makes that choice for you. That's what motivated albums like Sgt. Pepper's, or Paul's Boutique. and that's what was motivating us. While we were on the road, Dream Ampton, a poet, activist, and friend of the band, gave me a CD to listen to by a new artist. It was a demo, kind of rough and blunt, but I liked it, especially two songs called Bitch I'm Broke and Boy Life in America, which were kind of punk soul with very blunt lyrics. When Dream went into the gas station, I snuck a look at the CD and saw that it was a guy named Cody Chestnut, with two capital T's at the end. That was all, just a name. At that time, there was no social media yet. Not really. So the whole idea of expanding your network or using your network to teach you about how it might expand itself was foreign. I'd started an online community called OK Player, a mix between a message board and a chat room. I went on and asked if anyone knew about this Cody Chestnut. Most people didn't. A few days later, I went to MCA, our label, and one of the guys working there mentioned my OK Player post to me. He hadn't seen it, but one of his interns had. That's another thing about networks. They have to work across levels. If I'd been networking only with artists my age with similar experience and similar tastes, I would have never learned anything. The guy told me that he wasn't a huge fan of the record, but that he could find me a disc if I wanted. He went into a big bin that was like a CD graveyard and came up with a few copies of the CD. At that point, I was still in the frame of mind of seeing other people as a collaborative resource. The first thing that I thought of when I encountered a new talent wasn't what they reminded me of or how far they might go, but whether or not the roots could work with them in a way that made sense. I listened to the Cody Chestnut album with that in my head, and the song that jumped out at me was The Seed. It wasn't the most fully realized song, but it was sticky, like grip tape, with a good groove and plenty of room to grow into a hip-hop version. Collaboration isn't about what's there so much as what's not there. It's a jigsaw puzzle with a few pieces missing and a pile of bright pieces nearby. Tariq agreed, and after a few tries, he had new lyrics for it. We set up a session with Cody. The recording session was both a perfect example of the promise of a collaboration and a perfect example of the problems of collaboration. In those days, even more than now, I liked to record at night. Cody was supposed to land from California in the early evening and come right over, but someone, maybe it was Rich, wanted us to work earlier in the night rather than subject a new collaborator to my crazy schedule. That would have been fine, except it conflicted with another kind of collaboration. I had a date to go see a movie. I complained. Rich said it was fine, that they would just record without me, which he knew I wouldn't accept. I pushed my date a little later, told her I'd meet her at 8:15. We got ready for an efficient recording session. It wasn't always that way, but this time it had to be that way. Cody got to the studio about 7:30, said hello, hung out, and we didn't get down to real recording until about 7:55 or so. I was drumming with my coat already on. We got through the song once and had to go back for a second try, at which point the air conditioner blew my song map to the floor. "Don't stop the tape," I said. You can still hear that on the tape. That's still on there. Now it was almost 8. We went through that song again, and I went out the door. Those last 3 beats were done one-handed, with my other hand resting on my back. It wasn't an ideal collaboration, like you see sometimes in movies where two like-minded artists spend summer creating a series of paintings or figuring out a movie. But as quick as it was, it had a certain feel. It was the product of his energy and our energy in a way that I knew it would be the second I heard his album. Collaborations can be chemical like that. And it doesn't matter if they happen in a mansion over a course of a week or in a recording studio in one hectic night. Sometimes it's as simple as adding sodium to water and standing back. Don't do that at home. Don't even really do it in a nearby lake. Just watch the videos on YouTube instead. The magic was audible, and not just to us. The producer Don Was said that it was his favorite record of the year, and he played it for the Rolling Stones when he was producing them. "That's the kind of sound we want," he told them. "That's the best case scenario for collaboration. And it's most likely this will never happen to me again. Hear a song in the car, get the CD dug out of the bottom of a reject bin, call the guy, meet the guy, record with the guy, get a hit, get put in front of the Rolling Stones. An elastic band. At the time we were working with Cody, collaboration happened mostly along these two tracks. First, putting people in the same room for a long time and seeing what happened. Often, it's magic. Sometimes, it's just time passing. Second, hearing something that I knew would make a great combination and making it happen. Usually that works out on the plus side of the equation. But as the Roots got older, we started to have a better, or at least more complicated understanding of how to collaborate on music. A big factor in this was our day job as the band for Late Night, and then later, The Tonight Show, where we collaborated with people all the time. Here's how the job works. We come to the office and see a schedule of musical groups that have been booked as guests. Every once in a while, they'll bring in their own band. But often, the artist's name on the booking sheet means that we are, for that moment, that artist's band. For me, when I started, that meant that I had to suddenly learn a ton of new things. Not just new material, but a whole world of music. I was always pretty open to new things. As I've said, my dad had the record collection. And it wasn't a narrow one either. I heard all the music of the 70s in the 70s. And even my dad's influence was only part of a whole. My sister, who's a few years older than me, went to school and came back with exactly what you would expect. Steely Dan, or Boston, or Fleetwood Mac. My mom loved digging in the crates for cool albums with cool album covers, which meant that she ended up with the records that featured Monte Clarwine's paintings, such as Miles Davis' Bitches Brew. From an early age, I was all prepared to be diverse. And yet, Late Night was a little bit of a culture shock. At that time, in New York, there was a blossoming Brooklyn music scene. And I developed kind of stereotypical ideas about these Brooklyn bands early on. They were hipsters. They played rock and roll, but played it ironically. Whether that meant touching on 70s styles that they didn't completely embrace, or forging into a kind of math rock, where the whole idea of traditional verse, chorus, verse songs was challenged. About 6 months after we started, Late Night booked Dirty Projectors. I assumed just more of the same, Brooklyn band, attitude. They came in and went into the studio for afternoon rehearsal. The second they started playing, I was internally apologizing for assuming that they would be one way when they were, in fact, so many other ways. They have these three female singers doing complex syncopated vocals, and then they were just bursting to choir harmonies. I looked around trying to catch the eye of someone in the Roots. It ended up being Kirk, and the two of us just stared at each other. We were so shocked and impressed that when we got backstage, we were still humming. Kirk insisted it was Pro Tools. No one could have done live harmonies the way those women did it. While we were talking, Amber Kaufman, one of the singers, walked by us in the hallway. Kirk called her in and asked her if she could do the harmonies live. Sure, she said. She went and got the rest of the Dirty Projectors, and they recreated them. When I posted the video, it went viral. When it came time for the Roots to make our album, How I Got Over, in 2010, we put them on the record. Other people we met through Fallon were on there, too. We had the Monsters of Folk, Jim James, Bright Eyes, and M. Ward. We had the harpist and vocalist, Joanna Newsom. These were different kind of collaborations from Cody Chestnut, which happened because I heard a certain similarity. These collaborations happened because I heard certain differences. It wasn't only that we were going for a new sound as a band. We were going for a sound that itself contained multiple sounds. For ideas that were collisions. Those kind of combinations. Unexpected ones. But ones where both parties are determined to produce an outcome that lives up to their respective creative reputations are absolutely necessary. They may not always make for the best music, but they always make for the best creativity. They force you to define yourself again, which is vital for mid-career creative. In 2013, the Roots did a record with Elvis Costello called Wise Up Ghost. It grew out of his appearance on the show, where he loved playing with us, and we put together a set of songs, some new, some remakes of older material. Over the course of that record, we needed to understand what made us Roots in comparison to his Costello. And he had to understand the same project in the other direction. For bits of both artists to survive in the final product, they need to make themselves visible to one another and to themselves. Every successful collaboration is also a fight for your own creative life. It takes two. Some ideas are one-person ideas. Once they leave that one person, they can go through many other stages. They get produced or published or filmed, but they start inside one head. Other ideas are two-people ideas, truly collaborative efforts. Those ideas happen as a result of partnership, and creative partnerships are like other kinds of partnerships, lifelong friendships, business relationships. They have push and pull. They have ups and downs. They have times to speak and times to be silent. I have been in a band for more than two decades that has depended on collaboration, and I've watched other kinds of partnership, songwriting teams, comedy teams, writing teams. Being a collaborator is a constant learning experience. You quickly learn your strengths and your weaknesses. Admittedly, I'm not always a good communicator. I'm not always straightforward about asking what I want out of a creative partnership. I'm not always clear with myself on the difference between doing the work and running the operation. It can be difficult to deep dive inside yourself and figure out all the things about you that work and don't work, let alone the things that work and don't work in collaboration with someone else. But here are some general tips for making creative collaborations work. Set aside a time and a place. This is a fundamental principle and one that is too easily overlooked. Maybe your creative partner works better in the morning, but you prefer evenings. Some people will recommend compromising and meeting in the afternoon. That seems like a weak solution to me. I'd recommend a different type of compromise. Go morning one day, evening the next. Same with place. You don't always want to be the host. Sometimes make the trip to where your partner lives or works. This may seem obvious, but it's not just about accommodating the feelings of your partner. It's about making sure that the greatest number and widest variety of ideas make it out of the brainstorming process. Be open and curious and expect the same in return. We've talked about creative disinhibition and how creativity depends on not filtering your ideas so much that strange or unexpected ideas disappear. The same is true for a partnership. Be receptive to ideas that sound strange. Maybe be receptive to those ideas especially because the tendency is to be dismissive. When you give a fair hearing to a strange idea, you might loosen up your own idea to the point where it's significantly improved. Say you're collaborating on a song about returning veterans, and your songwriting partner suggests including a kind of calliope sound that gives the whole thing a carnival feel. Don't reject it out of hand. Maybe there's something to that. Maybe it's gallows humor, or it shows the way the government doesn't take its responsibility to vet seriously. And if that doesn't work, maybe the general idea of sound effects or a kind of novelty is a good one. Military drum beats? Too obvious? Maybe you're right, songwriting partner. But let's keep exploring. Analyze. They say that creativity is a mysterious process. And that's, of course, true to some degree. But one of the things I'm trying to do in this book, and for that matter in my life, is to demystify it, or at least show certain ways in which the mystery is a myth that people keep alive to avoid dealing with the nuts and bolts of the process. This goes for creative partnerships especially. You might think that working with a creative partner is about finding a groove, or jamming, or everyone nodding their heads when they reach that magic plateau where things are sounding just right. But it has to be more than that. Learning to be analytical about your collaboration is an important part of the collaboration. You may illuminate some of the uncomfortable dynamics or solve problems that you didn't even know were interfering with your progress. This is the second layer, the meta of Mo' Meta Blues. It's also the same principle as meditation. You're always in the booth and always outside the booth watching. Be clear with yourself and others about what's working and what's not working. Positive reinforcement works. One special form of communication is praise. You don't have to be insincere about it. No one likes to have smoke blown at them. But you can be honest about what is working in the creative process. If you're collaborating on a song and you're impressed by the idiosyncratic meter of the lyrics, say so. Your creative partner is taking risk, the same way that you are, hopefully. And you don't want to leave him or her hanging. Over the past year, I've tried to train myself to get better at administering praise, to control my trigger finger for criticism, and be better at dispensing praise. Because of my dad, I came from the Whiplash School of Motivation, where saying that someone else did a good job was seen as weakness. I definitely did not come from the world of participation trophies. I have a tendency to turn up my nose at people who aren't willing to use elbow grease and bloody knuckles to get further in the process. I don't believe in perfection, but I do believe in satisfaction. Still, now that I'm a little older and a little more mellow, I recognize that other people need praise. Working it all out. Even when you follow these helpful rules, collaboration is never going to be easy all the time. The most common problems in collaboration, in my experience, revolve around resentment. One person feels that his or her ideas aren't getting enough of a hearing, or that they're being twisted to suit the other person's ideas. The most common form of resentment, of course, comes at the end of the process, especially at the end of a successful process. I'll call to your attention a very odd thing that happened to the Beatles. Everybody knows a number of Beatles songs, assuming that they're human beings. And most everyone knows that when they're credited for their work, most of the songs are credited as collaborations between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, even when that wasn't entirely the case. Early on, the two men wrote together, but even as they started to develop their own styles within the group, that label stayed. Showbiz. Well, at some point in Paul McCartney's life, that arrangement started to rankle him. I'll let Paul take over here. This particular version comes from an article in New Musical Express, but it's a story that McCartney has told dozens of times.
We had a meeting with Brian Epstein, John and me. I arrived late. John and Brian had been talking. We were thinking we ought to call the songs Lennon and McCartney. I said, "That's okay, but what about McCartney and Lennon? If I write it, what about that? It sounds good, too." They said, "Okay, what we'll do is we'll alternate it. Lennon and McCartney, McCartney and Lennon." Well, that didn't happen. But what happened was, the anthology came out, and I said, "Okay, what they're now saying is, song by John Lennon and Paul McCartney." I said, "If you're doing that, it's not Lennon and McCartney. It's not the logo anymore." So in particular cases like Yesterday, which John actually had nothing to do with, none of the other Beatles had anything to do with it, and I said, "Could we have by Paul McCartney and John Lennon? Wouldn't that be a good idea? And then on Strawberry Fields, we'll have by John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Penny Lane, Paul McCartney, and John Lennon. Seeing as we're breaking it up, can't we do that?" And at first, Yoko said, "Yeah." Then she rang back a few days later, and she decided it wasn't a good idea. And it became a bit of an issue for me, particularly on Yesterday, because the original artwork had Yesterday by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and a photo of John above it. And I went, "Ah! Come on, lads!"
"Yes, lads. Arr." This is an incredible passage about an incredible chapter in pop music history. Collaborations, even those that are pleasant in the process, can be unpleasant in the product. Maybe you care if your name is first. Maybe you don't give a damn if they alternate. Maybe you're more satisfied by playing the title character than getting the highest billing. Just make sure that everyone's clear. Oh, and get to the meetings on time. When I was writing this chapter, a friend had an interesting suggestion. He said that collaborators should be as creative with issues of credit as they are with the original ideas. Start from a 50-50 split and then play some games to push it a few points one way or the other, he said. Or be listed alphabetically, but not by your name. By the word that represents the number of letters in your name. It's worth thinking about if only because it keeps the collaboration in its comfort zone. Focused on making things rather than on the things that have been made. We looked at how the process of locating yourself inside of a collaboration can function as a sort of redefinition. How you can come to see yourself anew when you see yourself next to different people. As I mentioned in connection with the Roots Elvis Costello collaboration, this makes you reassert your identity, but it can also make you revalue it. If you felt tall your whole life and started hanging out with the Knicks, you'd have to adjust accordingly. Collaboration could be like hanging out with the Knicks. You're not as tall as you thought you were, but you have other qualities that you didn't notice until you stopped being preoccupied with your height. This is a thornier issue, and potentially a more profound one. Collaboration can not only allow you to place yourself in close proximity with other creatives and watch what happens, but it can fundamentally change you. I mentioned before that some collaborations are like throwing sodium in water. What I didn't mention, because my grasp of chemical metaphors is limited, is that the sodium burns up. It's changed forever. There are examples of this in my own creative life. And one of them began on one of the most momentous days of our nation's history. On the morning of 9/11, I was in New York. The night before, the Roots had played a big Michael Jackson tribute show at Madison Square Garden, and our hotel rooms downtown didn't pan out for some reason. Our reservation had been dropped, or our credit card number had been transmitted incorrectly. Whatever the case, there were no rooms for me. It was one of those times in my career that I threw a full diva fit. A four to the floor. Do you know who I am? It didn't work. I was sent uptown to a different hotel in the Bryant Park area, where I went to bed, exhausted and frustrated. The next morning, I woke to the news. A plane had flown into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. A few minutes later, a second plane had flown into the South Tower. My first impulse was to run to the front desk to make sure that I could extend my stay. My second was to run outside and get a cab. New York was as silent as Vanilla Sky's first 10 minutes. But I managed to find a cabbie. I gave him $100 and told him that I only needed to make a short drive over to Virgin Megastore, and that I pay him to wait and drive me back. I loaded up on music. I can't remember all the records I got, but one of them was Jay-Z's The Blueprint, which was released that day. It became my post-9/11 soundtrack. I had mixed feelings about Jay-Z at that point. He had immense commercial success, and he didn't seem to have the necessary self-reflection or self-doubt. The gangster face put me off. But when I listened to The Blueprint in the wake of 9/11, I started to feel such a deep connection to it. I realized that Jay and I had plenty in common, including East Coast roots and the love for the music. We also had people in common, including the writer Dream Hampton. I told her that I had come around to Jay and to The Blueprint, and she passed the news along to him. He was thrilled, she said. That mattered too. I didn't know that he cared what I thought. That process was the beginning of a kind of collaboration, though it was mediated and abstract. It also helped me develop another one of my important theories about creative work. I had always believed that there were two types of artists. Type A, achievers, and type B, creatives. If I had written this book back in 1998, I would have depended upon this distinction. They were two different tribes, two different kinds of artists. Type A artists were very direct toward product. They produced a tremendous amount of work, often they're looked down upon by type B artists, who think of themselves as something more pure. Jay-Z, of course, was classic type A. That was part of the reason why I was suspicious of him. But about a month later, he sent out word that he wanted the Roots to back him on his Unplugged album. When we got the offer, I panicked. I had listened to The Blueprint solidly for a month. I had immense respect for him, a million times more than I had before. But I still wasn't sure about collaborating with him. We had our fans, and they saw us as this certain kind of thing. In shorthand, I'm using hardcore type B. For a little while, I avoided Jay's calls, and then I gave in. Still a tiny bit against my better judgment, It ended up being one of the best decisions of my creative life. As I've said, I've worked with hundreds of artists in my 3 decades in the business. And each and every one of the collaborations has had its own strange mix of ego jousting and creative strategy. Sometimes you have to rep for the idea you don't want because you know in advance that the creative process will reverse your suggestion. Sometimes you have to agree with everything you're presented while you're putting a third party up as a kind of agitator. Collaborating with Jay was the easiest thing in the world. He listened to everyone, asked questions, and then gave his opinion. The first few times we came to decision points, I couldn't believe how simple it was to work with him. In fact, that collaboration made me rethink my entire theory up until that point. During the year before the Jay-Z collaboration, as I've said, I've spent most of my time and most of my energy with a group of like-minded artists who have convened at my Philly house. Spending time with those artists was wonderful in nearly every respect, communal and miraculous. But it could also be backbreaking. Everyone was the same type of creative person, inspired and driven, but not conventionally self-confident, passionate about the ideas they wanted, but not straightforward and lucid in communicating those ideas. There were constant battles about listening and credit and all the kinds of things that were central to the creative process. Or so I thought until I worked with Jay. I had, in my mind, put him on the other side of the line, stereotyped him as a achiever rather than a creative. But we got so much creative work done with him, with a minimum of friction, that it changed my way of thinking. It taught me that different styles, not just different ideas, can be complementary rather than contradictory. And that creativity is a larger idea than I might have thought when I was just a young art punk. Later on, I ran across an interview with Bjork from the German show, Why Are You Creative? Bjork is talking with the host, Herman Vasky, and he mentions the British artist Damien Hirst, specifically an interview in which a reporter says something to Hirst about a piece of his, that he could have done it. Yes, Hirst says, but you didn't. Hirst's quote seemed defensive. I was more interested where Bjork took it.
I think everybody could do it. And for me, maybe I'm not so concerned if it's creative or not. Maybe because I'm brought up in such a working class situation and the people I admire most, like my grandmother or my family, if you would look at their passport, no one of them says artist. But for me, all of them have been very brave and completely stood by what they've made. To take care of a lamp shop is a very creative thing. Or to feed 8 children can be a very pro-life statement with all the hindrances and everybody wanting to stop you. My grandfather, he would show me a fireplace he has just made, and he's proud of it, just as proud as if I was playing a song.
For me, that crystallized some of the things I've been thinking since the Jay-Z experience. Maybe he wasn't as hung up on whether what he was doing was creative. I mean, it was, and he knew it was. But there's also that other personality, the hustler, the CEO as top dog hustler, the get things done guy. The person who instinctively recognized that people who aren't artists in the capital A sense were also doing things that they could be proud of and should have been proud of. It was more inclusive and maybe a little kinder in some ways. Artists who kept their capital A also kept a sense that they were somehow different from everyone else. That could be valuable. I knew that more than anyone. But maybe it could be a drawback. I know that this returns to something I said early on, which is that everyone is creative in some ways. If you think you're creative, you are. And maybe the more arty you are, the more you need to yin-yang it with an achiever. It produces results and reduces anxiety. I've seen versions of this principle many times over the years, but I didn't feel the full force of my Jay-Z revelation again until the 2016 Roots Picnic, when the band backed Usher on a full set of his hits. Going into it, I had some concerns. Would it be a good match? Would we fit together? Usher had a reputation as a guy who was more like Jay, a hitmaker, a chart dominator, a commercial presence who wasn't necessarily connected to the art on a deep level like, say, the Soulquarians. Again, I'm not saying this in a judgment or mocking way in either direction. I'm just differentiating between the two approaches to creativity. As it turned out, it was a dream. Usher was completely out of his comfort zone. He had been a solo act in the classic sense, whereas the Roots consistently work with different artists. But Usher had no fear. He gave us carte blanche to take his music to new places. In other collaborative environments, I was accustomed to seeing people say,
"No!"
brazenly, Electric Company style. I saw the word coming out of their mouths. I didn't see the word
"no"
coming out of Usher's mouth once. From the second I knew we'd be working with him, I started to have ideas about what needed to be done to his music. I was pursuing an idea, which was to return soul music to its spiritual basis. It used to be a music with uplift, a music that instilled survival strategies in African Americans. I wanted to work Usher's catalog with these goals in mind. When you talk about his catalog, you have to start with Confessions, which sold more than 10 million copies. It's a textbook example of how to make pop that works. I wanted to muddy it a bit. I wanted to take the flash away and put him in an environment that was more of a legitimate 70s concert, to trade some of the things in the songs that were synthetic for things that were emotional. I had peanut butter intended for the chocolate of Confessions. We played him our idea. We explained it. We worked through it. And then, because this is how collaborations work, and how the best ones work best, he started to contribute in ways that I couldn't have expected. He started to have ideas about arrangements, about performances, about pauses. We discovered to our surprise that he had a baritone.
He was doing some Barry White type ad-libs. Show you right.
It occurred to me that with more time, we could really do something with that. But there was a schedule. We had to keep it. The show itself was about 70% of the way to being the perfect rethink of Usher. But it was an amazing illustration of how achievers and creatives can stand in the same place and erase the idea that there is any real distinction between the two. Later on, I had Usher on my Pandora show, Questlove Supreme. And he was just as sharp there, just as willing to talk about creative limits and rethink his earlier work. My creative relationship with Usher and my respect for him has gone a long way towards changing my understanding of the difference between achievers and creatives. Social networks. These days, collaboration has a second meaning. There's a shadow collaboration that takes place online. When I discussed Cody Chestnut, how he came to our attention as an artist, how we reached out to him, I mentioned that I went on OK Player to ask fans if they knew anything about him. That was in the early days of the medium. We had the web, but we didn't have anything close to the social network environment of today, which is rich with, or rotten with, depending on your perspective, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, you name it. I use technology as much as anyone. It starts in the morning when I wake up and check my phone. It ends at night when I check my phone and go to sleep. In between, I'm online like most people, which is to say that I'm online all the time. When I'm on there, I'm interacting and interfacing with people in a variety of ways. I'm reading other people's posts, noting who's reading and responding to mine, piecing together a tissue of sources and authorities. The internet has indisputably changed the way we read and think and converse. So why wouldn't it change the way we create? It has, of course, and it's natural to worry that it's changing for the worse. One of the things I read recently online was a spirited defense of the internet as a creative environment. It was written by a marketing professional, so I approached it with more than a little skepticism, but it also made good sense, so I felt my skepticism draining as I went through it. I don't remember the guy's name, but he made an argument that most real creativity comes from the combination of unexpected things. It's the Reese's Peanut Butter Cups theory of how things get made. And it has some validity. He talked about Picasso and African art as one prominent example. If I'm going to quote the guy, I should go find the piece. Hold on. Okay, got it. It's from Forbes Online from 2014. And the writer is named Greg Sattell. He used Picasso as one example. And he also mentioned how Darwin combined insights from economics, geology, and biology to come up with his theory of natural selection. He went on to say that the very notion of combination comes up in most theories of creativity, including Douglas Hofstadter's theory of strange loops. I didn't know much about strange loops, so I took a little time to read about them. Hofstadter wrote about these loops in the context of M.C. Escher, whose drawings seem to take you all the way around a certain mental or physical journey, only to return you to the same place where you started. Hofstadter talks about how this takes you through several levels, where you think you're moving down or up, but are in fact not moving. It's your perception that's moving. He takes it into complicated ideas of mathematics, but also into simpler ideas of psychology. The self, he says, is one of these loops. We pass through a bunch of layers on the ways to coming back and being the same self. And we only make symbols about our existence and the stories about ourselves because of these loops. The internet, Satel argues, is a great and efficient vehicle for creating these kinds of loops and for connecting us to other loops. Maybe in passing, someone would mention something to me, a strange reference like Hofstadter's loops, or the way a certain Roots record reminds them of Roland Barthes or Ishmael Reed. It used to take me a significant amount of time and effort to get me to track down those references and then figure out how they fit into what I was working on. Now it all happens in a few mouse clicks. Networks can and do form more quickly than they once did. And people can and do see connections more easily than before. In that sense, all of the benefits of networks that I just outlined are right there in front of us. One good example of this is coming up with song titles. I have a friend who's a songwriter. He doesn't like to name his songs after words in his lyrics. I don't know why he doesn't just take the easy way out. It worked for Al Green and James Brown and the Beatles. But he wants to name his song Weird Things. He used to have a complicated way of finding words. He would drive around town, noticing words on signs, and then he saw a word twice. He'd use it. It was a variation of that game that kids play on long road trips, where they have to find a word that starts with a word that starts with B, and so on. Maybe people don't think of that game as creative, but it is. It's giving shape to a set of words that are otherwise randomly scattered on the signs. And his driving around was also creative, because it attached titles to songs. In the last few years, he started adapting the title-finding strategy for the internet. Now he'll type the course into a search engine and pay attention to the kind of sites that come up in return. I don't want to step on his work, so I'll illustrate using a root song. Say the Seed 2.0. Now, if I search on Seed and Push and Life, what do I get? Most of the results I get are links to the lyrics for the song. Let me do this again. All right. Subtract roots from the search. Now I get results for skateboarding sites. For something called Push. Persevere until success happens through prayer. Really? Isn't that push? For 5 tips to help with tomato and pepper seed germination. If I were titling songs the way my friend does, I might call it Tomato and Pepper Germination, a perfectly good, strange name for a song. And because the internet works by odd association, it also sparks odd association. The fan who sees that a song is called Tomato and Pepper Germination goes backwards through the same loop, thinks that it's strange or gets used to it, but does his or her own version of hitting all those different levels and combining them into something new. This is just a new form of free play that becomes possible because of the capabilities of search engines. But remember, free play is one of the most important forms of creativity. That's the good news about the internet. Well, it's not all the good news. We didn't get to the economics or distribution technologies or the way in which it has pulled in the distant corners of the world. But for each of these pieces of good news, there's a piece of bad news. What's the bad news with creativity and the internet? As luck would have it, the bad news is also on the internet. As long as I've been going online, I've had the suspicion that it was doing something to my brain. Not necessarily making it weaker, but transforming it into a different kind of instrument. Rather than stay inside itself and cultivate ideas, it knows that it has to go out into the world and find ideas that match some impulses and instincts that are beginning to stir. With the help of the online world, the brain is a more hunter-gatherer and less a farmer. At some fundamental level, that seemed less creative, or, at the very least, less of the process of creation was taking place inside my own head. The most complete version of this theory came from a guy named Nicholas Carr, who argued that the internet actually changes the shape of our brain and how it works. Or at least that's what I think it says. Carr wrote a book called The Shallows. I didn't read the entire book, though I read the article in The Atlantic that became the basis for it. Is that shallow? It was called, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And it came out way back in 2008, when the internet's hold on us was weaker than it is today. In the piece, Carr says that he noticed that his experiences with the internet were changing the way his brain felt to him. I can feel it most strongly when I'm reading. Immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy. My mind would get caught up in the narrative or the terms of the argument, and I'd spend hours strolling through long stretches of prose. That's rarely the case anymore. Now my concentration often starts to drift after two or three pages. I get fidgety, lose the thread, begin looking for something else to do. I feel as if I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle. Luckily, that was at the beginning of the article. There seemed to be thousands more words, but I didn't read it. I'm kidding. I did. An article I can still handle, but I know what he means. We've all felt it. Reading is a different experience than when we were young. Each word offers the possibility for linking out to something else. And the main text just doesn't have the same gravity it once did. But is this larger network actually providing us with a larger understanding? Towards the end of the piece, there's a consideration by the playwright Richard Foreman of the new way of processing information. Foreman noted that while our minds hold more information than before, there are more than ever a series of connections to information outside of our minds. And too much is about information, locating it, retrieving it. This, said Carr, quoting Foreman, is alarming. As we are drained of our inner repertory of dense cultural inheritance, Foreman concluded, we risk turning into pancake people, spread wide and thin as we connect with that vast network of information accessed by the mere touch of a button. Everyone agrees that creativity is a privileged form of thinking, but is it immune to this effect, or is it more vulnerable to it? I have said before that creativity can be defined in many ways, and that one of the ways is that it's the attempt to answer a question that is itself in question. If a question comes into perfect focus, answering it isn't a creative act anymore. It's more of a matter of information retrieval. The internet, if you believe Foreman, if you believe Carr, is a menace to creative questioning. The second a question comes into view, the research process starts. We begin our research, our search for facts to satisfy questions, almost immediately. And just as Carr noticed his reading changing, I personally noticed the way that research sprints ahead of idea formation. When a certain soundscape appears in my mind, I match it immediately to a song on Spotify. When a certain faint picture of an old TV show appears, I find the original show on YouTube. When a lyrical phrase pops up, I Google it and find that it's from a Schoolie D song, or an Ice Cube song, or a SZA song. The best illustration, maybe, is the exception instead of the rule. Recently, I was thinking of a song from the 80s. I didn't know exactly of the song I was thinking of. It was one of those nostalgic twinges. I thought at first it was Baltimore's Tarzan Boy, but then a split second later I realized it wasn't that at all. The song I had in mind was something slower, more mysterious. But I didn't have any way to find it. Beyond that, I was at a loss. I didn't remember what month I heard the song, or else I could have gone and looked up the Billboard charts from that month. I didn't remember even a few words of lyrics, or else I could have searched for that phrase. Maybe in the future, there'll be a way to mine your mind for a snatch of melody and reverse shazam it. But I couldn't retrieve the song. Because of that, I just sat there and thought about it. I got further and further away from the reference job at hand, and closer and closer to an idea of my own. Denied the ability to complete the research task, I instead pursued a creative goal. I started to invent a new song that matched the characteristics in my head. I started to sing nonsense lyrics. They were about a new chair in my apartment, and it went something like, "New chair, there you are, there. I don't mean to stare, but I'm aware you're a new chair." I'm not claiming that it was a Johnny Mercer special, but I heard the entire new song coming to life in my mind, and I knew it wouldn't have happened if I'd been able to quickly locate the song in question. Now, it's true that my brain, in making this pre-song, was drawing from a network of its own. It was doing something similar to what a person does during the surfing process. But it was drawing on a deep well of various kinds of things. William Klim, a professor at Texas A&M University, wrote an article where he looked at the creative process from a neurological point of view. Much of the stuff he said is above my pay grade. As I've said, if you want me to be a neurologist, send me to the Neurology Academy, or whatever it's called. But one part I understand, he defines creativity as the process of drawing water from a deep well. I'm paraphrasing. He said that creativity comes from a mind that knows and remembers a lot. We don't have those brains anymore. Instead, we offload our knowledge to our phones and computers, to Wikipedia, to Shazam. It's a great convenience, but what's lost in the process? And I think that Klim's answer is only partial. Creative minds know and remember a lot, but that also means that they have to know and remember selectively. One of the things that's being lost, along with the ability to really focus and concentrate on the bottom of that well, is the ability to establish hierarchy, a confident sense of knowing which events or ideas are the big planets and which ones are the small moons orbiting around them. I probably just mixed a metaphor. Consider it a mashup. Dave Chappelle, in one of his two comeback specials on Netflix in the spring of 2017, talked about when he was young, and one of his middle school teachers wheeled a television into class so that the students could watch the launch of the Challenger space shuttle. I'm a little older than Dave, and I remember it too. It was 1986. It was a big deal. There was a teacher on board, and every other teacher wanted to share in the glory. Of course, it all went horribly wrong. The launch went fine, but a few minutes later, the shuttle exploded. All the astronauts were killed. Students and teachers across the country watched, stunned. The punchline to Dave's bit about it is subtle. The teacher, staring at the screen, dismisses the class for the day. You can all go home. But after that, Dave makes a point that's deeper than a punchline. He starts to needle the younger people in the audience. "These days," he says, "you guys get so much more news, so much more data, that everything is the space shuttle. So nothing is the space shuttle. Just when you filled your mind and your heart with the horror, or in the cases the joy or the significance of an event, another one comes along to wipe it away. How do you grow up in an environment like that? For creativity, things need to settle in, take root, flower, bloom, grow, tangle. The skim, the superficial. The way things get replaced so quickly is the enemy of not only deep thoughts, but of creative thoughts. I guess I want to leave all internet users, in other words, everyone, with words of caution. Of course, use technology. No one is suggesting that you unplug or that you wander the earth only as far as your landline cord will let you go. But don't think that giant hive mind out there is a replacement for your own mind. And don't forget to have the courage to set aside most of what you're being delivered. And deliveries, as Chappelle says, come in constantly. When we network with other people, we learn to use them as trusted resources. When we network with technology, we learn that resources are countless, but not all trustworthy. It's a balancing act. Stay upright. The Connect Effect. Think of two artists you know who you consider to be very different, and imagine what project they would make if they collaborated. Reduce,
reuse, recycle.
Unblock party. Getting started on an average day can be a pain, but it's a pain that most people can deal with, like a slight headache or a sore heel. For some creative people, though, the pain of not being able to be efficiently creative doesn't go away. It just stays and stays, getting worse, or worse, not getting worse at all, just staying and staying, until you're numb from it. When that happens, when you can't feel your extremities, creatively speaking, you might be in the clutches of writer's block, or whatever the equivalent is in your creative field. Songwriter's block, painter's block, chef's block, filmmaker's block, they all sound bad. Except maybe sculptor's block, which sounds like it could be the start of something promising. For years, I would hear people talk about writer's block. I didn't encounter it firsthand or even secondhand that often, so I had a kind of superstitious feeling about it. I didn't want to know. But the more I went into the music world, the more I saw it. And sometimes I saw it close up. When D'Angelo was young, he played in a group called Precise. They came up from Richmond, Virginia to play the Apollo Theater in 1991. And that led to a publishing contract. And that led to work for Black Men United, which was a vocal choir that had almost everyone in it. Gerald Levert, Raphael Sadiq, Boyz II Men, R. Kelly, Usher. D'Angelo got launched. He recorded Brown Sugar, his debut, and when it came out in 1995, everyone knew it was one of the most creative forces around. You could feel it in the way that he arranged vocals, and the way that he let songs drift but never became aimless. He had a great voice, but lots of people could sing. He had a perspective. He had force. He had ideas. But in the wake of that album, he had something else too, which was trouble writing new material. There was a pressure on him for a follow-up because Brown Sugar had been such a big hit, but a follow-up didn't happen easily. It wasn't that he couldn't go back to the well. He went back there, but when he went back, it was dry. I'm not telling tales out of school or anything. He's talked plenty about that period. His first album summed up everything that he thought and felt. He had found a way to express his entire soul. That's why they call it soul music. So how are you going to bounce right back up with a new record? There's a phrase that people like to use to describe these situations. They say, sophomore slump. But that's a little bit of a misnomer. No one's in school anymore. It's just a slump, period. D'Angelo really suffered while he struggled to get more material together in the wake of Brown Sugar. He was completely blocked, locked up tight. For a guy who woken up day after day for years with new songs blooming in his mind, to suddenly be looking at an empty flower pot was a terrible feeling. He kept on, though. What he did mostly was release cover versions of other people's songs for soundtracks. He and Erykah Badu did a Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell duet, Your Precious Love, for High School High. He did Heaven Must Be Like This, the Ohio Players Ballad, for Down in the Delta. He'd done covers before, of course. One of the big hits from his debut was a version of Smokey Robinson's Cruisin'. But these were one-offs. They weren't destined for the follow-up record, though people may have thought so at the time. They were just hanging there in the space between records. Some people will say it was a business move or a branding move, a way of keeping the new star visible for a little while he got his act together, creatively. Some people did say it, but to me that's too cynical, or rather, it's irrelevant. Those covers were fully creative works, ways of making things without recording his own songs. He weaponized another aspect of his creativity and temporarily vaporized the issue of writer's block. I think there was a kind of psychological freedom in them too, at least a little bit. Creativity is a privilege and a blessing, but it's also at times a burden. The pressure of coming up with your own ideas, or rather, your own ideas, with all the capital letter significance that implies, can be a problem. It's not that the pressure crushes you. I don't think that's what happened to D'Angelo. It wasn't like he read an early draft of a press release that talked about the follow-up to Brown Sugar and then suddenly felt paralyzed. I think that his block was more about having emptied out the tank in a very comprehensive and exhausting way, then promoting that album around the clock for 2 years. It was difficult